This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today we use the word mammoth to talk about things that are really, really big. But the actual thing the word refers to, the prehistoric elephant-like creature, hasn't been around since the end of the last ice age. A new company called Colossal says it wants to grow some new mammoths and introduce them to the melting tundra of Siberia. Can it be done? Should it be done? Beth Shapiro is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's the author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Her forthcoming book, out in about a month, is called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the science here. And I've been careful not to use the word clone or cloning here, Beth, because as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, this is not cloning they're talking about.
Right. Well, when people think of cloning, the thing that comes to mind first is Dolly, right? Dolly the sheep, this famous clone. But the trick to cloning a mammal, and because we can't clone other things like birds, we just don't have the technology yet. But the trick to cloning is to having a living is to have a living cell. And for something like a mammoth, where the most recent mammoths died more than 3,000 years ago, we don't have any living cells. So we need different technology if we're going to bring one of these things back to life.
So what is Colossal talking about doing then that's going to make at least mammoth-like creature?
In my field, which is called ancient DNA, we have learned that we can go out into the tundra and we can find frozen bones and teeth and, you know, sometimes entire mummified bodies of mammoths, and they have DNA in them. They don't have any living cells, but they have DNA. It's all broken down and chewed up and in tiny pieces, but we can extract it and then take these billions or trillions of fragments and gradually, slowly piece them together to make the whole sequence of a mammoth's genome. And then on a computer, we can compare that to an elephant's genome and figure out all the places that they're different. So what Colossal are thinking of doing is using that sequence that we have on a computer that we learned by looking at mammoth DNA and living cells from elephants. Asian elephants are the closest living relative of mammoths, and gene editing technologies like CRISPR, and then gradually tweaking the DNA in those living elephant cells until the genome in there, the DNA code, looks like that from a mammoth. And then, voila, you've got a living mammoth-ish cell.
Okay, so we got a cell. Yeah, what do we do with that cell?
Well, then the step is to clone it. That would be the same technology. We take that cell, we trick it into forgetting all the instructions to be whatever type of cell it is. Normally, in a dish in the lab, it's a skin cell or a muscle cell or something like that. But it has to forget those instructions and then revert into the type of cell that can start to divide and become all the different cell types that make up a whole animal. And once that has happened, we then can have a little embryo that's developing in a cell, and you could implant that into a surrogate host. So this is another place that Colossal's stumbled across a problem and a potential solution. The problem here is elephants. No one's ever done IVF on an elephant successfully. There's, you know, plus, I mean, ethically, it's a little problematic, right? Like if we can do this for elephants, we should probably be making more elephants rather than using surrogate elephant moms to make mammoths, right? Or something mammoth-like. We can get into that too. But so what they've decided they're going to do is invent an artificial womb for an elephant, you know, like a big giant robotic womb that can bring these embryos somehow all the way to term. Elephants have an almost 2-year gestation too. So this would be a really smart robot that knew how to do lots of things in developmental biology that we don't really know how to do yet. And this is technology we don't have, right? But, you know, think big, right? Mammoth-like. Think colossally. Oh, that was too much, right?
Now, okay, suppose we overcome, or Colossal overcomes, these technological hurdles, and you've got a baby mammoth-ish creature. My understanding of modern-day elephants is they're very strong parental bonds, or at least maternal bonds. If I'm raising a baby mammoth without a mama mammoth, is that something I'd really call a mammoth without that social upbringing in its life?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing about clones, right? We know from research all over the place that we're more than the A's and C's and G's and T's, those DNA letters that make up our genomes. All of us know clones, right? Do you know identical twins?
Very well, because I have a pair of them.
Oh, there you go. Well, they're clones, right? But they're different. They're different from each other. Right? And so when, just because you have something that's genetically identical doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be. And those differences, they start early on. You know, if an Asian elephant and a mammoth, we know that there are about 1.5 million differences in their DNA code that differentiate them. That's about the same as between us and chimpanzees, right? So how would we take something, even if it's been gene edited to look like one of these species or the other, and put it in that other species to develop, or into a robot where we don't really understand what the triggers are to turn genes on and off or up and down and really have this developmental process go? And then, as you say, it's born. And how does it learn to act? How does it learn to be that species? And, you know, this is part of the problem. Elephants also do this thing called coprophagy, where the mom feeds the baby a little bit of her own poop so that the community of microorganisms that they need to digest their food gets established in their guts. Now, we have no idea if having a mammoth community of microorganisms is really different than having an elephant community of microorganisms, but you presume it is to some extent. And whether that has any difference in what the animal looks like, I mean, we just don't know. And then elephants have these tight bonds, not just maternal bonds, but really community level bonds. You know, they're very social animals and they wander around. There's no reason to suspect that a mammoth wouldn't have been the same. And, you know, their goal is not to create one, but to actually create populations of animals that have all the different biological sexes and or both biological sexes. And then all the different all of the different generation times. So you have grandparents and parents and young ones, et cetera, to teach them how to act and to behave and to move around and to find resources and to interact with the other things in their habitats. And those aren't going to exist. They for a long time in the wild, elephants, I think it takes at least until their teenage years for them to become reproductively mature. So if you think about what it might take to have several generations of mammoths that are a population that can wander around the tundra and do all of these things that Colossal and the scientists working there are imagining that they're going to do, it's going to take a long time, even if we were to get over all of these technical hurdles relatively quickly. And by that, I think they're saying, you know, 6 years to 10 years or so for an artificial womb and a baby mammoth.
We're talking about a company planning to bring back a new version of the extinct woolly mammoth. Beth Shapiro is with us, author of books, including How to Clone a Mammoth and the forthcoming Life as We Made It. Beth, I'll wave a magic wand. All the technology problems are solved. Should we do it? Should we bring back woolly mammoths?
Well, this is a difficult question. So their argument is that woolly mammoths they probably played a really important role in their landscape, right? And because we know that elephants do in the landscape that they are, and they're arguing that if you have all of these big mammals around, they're going to wander around the tundra and they're going to remove snow from the surface of the ground during the winter. And snow is a very efficient insulator, right? So if you remove snow, then the cold Arctic winter air hits that ground and it freezes it more thoroughly. And there are scientists up in northeastern Siberia at a place called Pleistocene Park who've done some experiments and shown that when you have large mammals on the landscape, the dirt, the permafrost, the frozen dirt under the ground stays colder than if you don't have it there. And so they're arguing that if you put these animals back on the landscape, you can keep all that carbon and methane that's trapped in the permafrost there rather than spitting it out into the atmosphere to contribute to global warming. This, to me, feels a little bit far-fetched. I mean, you would need a lot of animals to do this, and I don't think that we should be focusing on this as our solution to the climate crisis. We obviously need other solutions other than this. But if we are thinking about putting something back on the landscape that does have a particular ecological role, maybe it's spreading around nutrients or distributing seeds or helping that ecosystem to regenerate these services that were lost when the animal went extinct, then maybe there's some reason to do it. I argue that we are never going to see something that's identical to a mammoth, but we don't really need something that's identical to a mammoth if we just need something that can perform those roles, those services that the mammoth once provided. And to me, this is why I like to think about the technology. And this is one of the reasons I'm actually genuinely excited about the investment into Colossal and really thinking about developing technologies where we're using these new biotechnologies maybe not to bring species back that are gone, but anything that they develop along the way, all of the resources for doing multiple edits, even artificial wombs, really understanding how the genomes of organisms that we don't normally have in a lab look and act, these have immediate payoffs for biodiversity conservation of things that are still alive. And it's so hard to get investment into biodiversity conservation. People would argue that, you know, any money that we get that we put into this kind of work, there's a fantastic nonprofit called Revive and Restore that's out of Sausalito near San Francisco in California that have been involved with a project to introduce genetic diversity into populations of black-footed ferrets, right? So black-footed ferrets, they thought were extinct, and then they found a population that was still alive, but they don't have very much genetic diversity. And when they release them into the wild, they get sylvatic plague from eating prairie dogs and they die. And so one of the solutions to this is to introduce genetic diversity from other black-footed ferrets, if they existed, or potentially from species like the domestic ferret, which is a cousin of theirs, but that is genetically immune to plague. And Revive and Restore have been involved with a project with San Diego Zoo, where a few months ago, a kit was born, a baby blackfoot ferret that was cloned from cells that were preserved frozen at the San Diego Zoo for around 40 years. So resurrecting genetic diversity from the past to introduce into this population, really dramatically increasing their diversity and potentially their chance to survive in their captive environment. And they're now working with Fish and Wildlife and some other organizations to identify what it is in domestic ferrets that makes them resistant to plague, to potentially use that technology to move traits between species using gene editing. These are really cool new biotechnological solutions for biodiversity preservation, not de-extinction, biodiversity preservation, like addressing a crisis that we have right now. And the investment into companies like Colossal is new money into conservation that's going to have such tremendous benefits for conservation. I think it's really exciting.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us and hope to talk to you about your new book in not too long.
Thanks.
That's Beth Shapiro, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth and the forthcoming book I just mentioned, Life as We Made It. We talked to her today about a new company trying to do the title of her older book, clone or not effectively recreate mammoths, and whether it's a good or even ethical idea.